Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're sitting in the International Culinary Center, and I'm very excited because with me I have one of my favorite chefs. He didn't even know it. He didn't even know that I've been in his restaurant. But I have to say, if you did not know that this man was American, you would never, ever believe he wasn't Italian. Thomas McNaughton is the chef at Flour and Water in San Francisco, a restaurant that has the 2015 Bib Gourmand from Michelin Guide. It's constantly in San Francisco Chronicle's top 100 Bay Area restaurants, the Condé Nast Traveler Best New Restaurant in San Francisco, the Central Kitchen that he has in 2013, GQ, Travel and Leisure, Zagat. He was a Zagat 30 Under 30 honoree, 2011-13, James Beard Rising Chef Star. You know, he's one of those types of chefs that's like on every list, and anything he does, everybody's going to eat up. So welcome, Thomas. Well,
thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, well, let's get started. I'm so happy to hear, even though you have one of the hottest restaurants in San Francisco, you're a local boy from New Jersey. Yeah. So were you born in New Jersey?
I try to hide that I'm from South Jersey.
But no, don't say that on the East Coast.
Yeah, South Jersey. Like 30 minutes south of Philly.
Uh-huh. So did you surf at Stone Harbor?
Of course, yeah. Absolutely.
You can't say that's bad.
Yeah, no. No, the Jersey Shore is a beautiful place.
And it's warmer than the Pacific.
It certainly is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So are you surfing out in the Pacific?
A little bit. I don't have that much free time right now, but, you know.
Okay. So tell us about growing up. Were you weaned on Jersey tomatoes?
We'd always experiment with different types of peppers and tomatoes, and it was beautiful.
So what kind of student were you?
I was a terrible student.
Oh, tell us about
yeah.
it.
I have some sort of ADD nature where I'm always hopping around, you know. And I think that, in school there was just, if I was assigned any sort of work, it was always like pulling teeth. But if I was interested in something, if I was really engaged in something, I really kind of immersed myself into it and you know, that's kind of where I fell into kitchens as well at such a young age.
So with a name like McNaughton, you know, doing pasta comes naturally, right? So what kind of food were you weaned on?
I say that I was culinary abused as a child. You know, my mother's not the best cook. I hope she hasn't listened to this interview. But, it was South Jersey food, you know. It was,
so what's South Jersey food?
Philly cheesesteaks and, pizza and... we always had a meal on the table, but
okay. So, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up?
Bagels, and I still miss them. You know, and that's it. That's all it needs. And it's just something that you don't see that often on the West Coast. Pork roll, egg and cheese sandwich, like Taylor ham they call it in North Jersey. I still kind of, sometimes I'll ship them out to San Francisco.
So when you were 7 years old, what did you want to be?
Oh, I think it probably changed once a week at least, you know.
Well, you were jumping up and down.
You know, my parents always poke fun at me that every single week I had a different hobby, you know. And all I wanted was a bow and arrow, and I would beg for a bow and arrow, and I would save up, and I'd get a bow and arrow, and then a week later I'd put it down, and, you know, I wanted to be a professional BMX biker, and that's all I wanted. And so I really did kind of hop around a lot.
So when did this culinary epiphany happen, where you moved on from a bagel?
Yeah, I mean, it started with, and it's kind of strange to say, it really started with the dynamics of a professional kitchen. I started washing dishes when I was 14 years old, and it was this amazing dynamic of a professional kitchen that I really fell in love with. So it was really first the dynamics of the kitchen and then food.
Was it a fine dining restaurant that you were in?
I started in country clubs, and just as a short order cook, and what was first as a dishwasher, and then moving into a short order cook, and I just fell in love with the atmosphere, you know.
Do you mean the people and the family type atmosphere a team gets, or did you like the food? Or
I mean, I always loved using my hands. You know, it was the nature of that team atmosphere. And you know, if you excelled, if you were really good, I mean, in a kitchen, you can move up very quickly if you really put your head down. And I love it. My dream job is to be a woodworker. When I grow up, I'm going to be a woodworker, you know. And it's the dynamic of that team about, you know, all these crazy things. I mean, you know, professional kitchens, it's mayhem. It's controlled chaos every single day. And I just kind of fell in love with that atmosphere. And then slowly, 15, 16 years old, started to take it really seriously, you know. I always tell people I would buy cooking equipment, and I would tell my friends it was for my girlfriend or my mother, and I was embarrassed by it, you know, creating meals at home and starting to experiment. And it was.
So what did your parents think?
I mean, they certainly embraced it right away. I mean, I think that, not to say it was too long ago, but it wasn't where, you know, it wasn't that tough yet. And that was kind of, didn't really happen quite that time. And so, I mean, they always embraced it. They just loved that I was interested in something and sticking to it, you know?
So did they, your father owned a nursery.
Right.
That was, and so did you have any special attachment to the land? Did you have to work with him? Did you get your hands in the soil, or?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, even before I started washing dishes, the probably 10, 11 years old when I started to kind of help out on the farm, and the dream job of being a woodworker would be on a farm, you know? It's something where I might be skipping ahead here, but the reason why I've kind of planted the roots in California, you know, having access to these amazing, amazing farms and being connected with the products is one of the most important things to me. It's almost it's certainly a part of the job description of being a chef in Northern California, is understanding where your food comes from and the entire process. And you know,
well, I think everybody's getting to that
right,
point
certainly.
Today for a lot of reasons, but we'll get into that, as you said before. So when you were 14 years old, what would your best friend say you were? Where was Thomas going to be, or if you called your Tom? If they said, tell us about him, and what is he going to be 10 years from now? What would your best friend have said?
Unfortunately, in South Jersey, when I was 14 years old, they probably called me Tommy, you know?
Yeah. Well, I call my brother Tommy from Brooklyn, though. Yeah, I get it. Okay, Tommy.
What would they say?
Yeah.
Who was your best friend when you were 14?
Probably a guy named Mike Sperry, yeah.
Okay, so what would Mike tell us about you?
I think, you know, I was a little bit of a troublemaker.
I like to hear that.
A little bit of a troublemaker, yeah. So I think it'd be uncertain, you know, of where I'd end up. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I think that... I think people were surprised. My friends, like, as I evolved in the kitchen, you know, and starting to get ready, you know, going through high school, and I think they're all very surprised that that I wanted to go to culinary school or to be a chef, you know. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at the very beginning, I was almost slightly embarrassed by it, you know.
Yeah. So you went to CIA. So when did you make that decision? And were you in? Did you go right after high school? Or
I took a year off. I really wanted to work for a year, and I think it's like really important to have a foundation or a basis. I think that any school that you attend and you have a foundation or a basis, you're able to pull so or draw so much more from it because you understand it a little bit more. You know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And you know, I think it's important that you don't pick up a chef's knife for the first time. You know, you really understand. You have a foundation of fundamentals of cooking to then go off and absorb every single thing you can. You know.
So, but you didn't stay at the CIA incomplete. You sort of took a break after you were there.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
I was looking for an externship, and I was sending my resume to. I really wanted to go to Northern California, and I knew that. And so
while you were at school,
right? And so, and part of that was just to get as far away as I possibly can and go explore. And so I was sending my resumes to all these amazing restaurants in the Bay Area. And one of the restaurants they sent it to was La Folie, which is a very, very classic. Roland Pesso is the chef there. And same thing, I wanted a basis of fundamentals of in what I was thinking then was an old school French restaurant, you know. And he was the only person that called me back directly. And very, very thick accent. I had no idea what he was saying on the phone. And I really wanted to do my externship there. And it didn't really work out with the school. They weren't accepting non-paid externships at the time. And he said, come out and work for 2 weeks for free. And if we like you, we'll hire you. And so that's what I did. So I left school, put everything in one suitcase, moved to a old bar. I rented an apartment on Craigslist with no pictures. Didn't even see it. And it was in the Tenderloin of San Francisco. And the Tenderloin is not the nicest, the friendliest neighborhood. And it was turned out it wasn't even zoned to be an apartment. It was an old barber shop. It still had the black and white tiles. And there was a futon and a half fridge. And you walked into what was the boiler room of the entire building. Now, it sounds like I couldn't even make this up, you know? Into the boiler room of the entire building. And the shower was just the sink and the handle of the faucet of the sink lifted up. And that was it. There was a drain on the floor.
What year was this?
This was in 2002. Mm-hmm. And just fell in love with the city. I mean, that was the first, and especially the restaurant. It was the big city restaurant. You know, totally out of my element. You know, way in over my head. And
what was your first position with Roland?
This was Garmager. Mm-hmm. You know. I mean, talk about an intense atmosphere. You know. And it's just a very, very tiny kitchen. It's very busy. A ton of food comes out of it. And, it was definitely.
How many covers a night?
I think that at 90 covers, the wheels are coming off, you know? And it's a fine dining restaurant. And so
you went back to school after that?
Well, I didn't want to leave. I thought it was an amazing opportunity to go work there. It was never my intention to leave school, but I did. I left for a year because I worked there for 2 weeks for free. On the last day, he under his breath said, okay, he's going to start paying me. And I worked there for about a year, and I just wanted to go. I wanted to go and finish up and get my degree. And
So the externship at CIA, is it a year long?
No. So it's only a couple of months. But I ended up using that for my externship. So they allowed to like pass it through eventually. And
So was it because you loved San Francisco, you stayed there that year, or because you loved the restaurant or the whole thing? And
the whole kit and caboodle. I mean,
because you were really bucking the school at that time, since you didn't go back.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. Definitely.
You're a bit of a troublemaker, aren't you?
It was just a great opportunity for me to see that, and I thought, what a great opportunity to stay here for a year. Mm-hmm. And then, if they let me come back and finish up school, then great.
It was probably even better because you had a whole year.
No, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so I went to, when I was working at La Folie, on my weekends I was staging. I was always, I was so heads down and, really wanted to push myself, and I would stage at other restaurants, and I started to develop a relationship with Gary Danko, which is another fine dining restaurant in San Francisco. And I would go there on the weekends, and I just kept coming back, you know. And I think
where does this come from? You have parents who are not particularly into food.
Right.
You know, you're not eating anything inspirational when you're young. You go to a country club. Yeah. No, but a country club right. isn't about, you know, it isn't like you
it's
had
a step up from hospital food.
I mean. Yeah, exactly. So where is the wellspring?
It was a combination of so many things, and I would always end up doing something with my hands, building something or creating something. And, you know, it's there's how do you explain? I mean, the title of a chef or the job description of being a chef is, you know, it's 100 to 1,000 things. It's certainly not one dimensional. And that's what I love about it. I love the creative nature of it. I love the physical skill of working with your hands and creating something. I love the atmosphere of a collaborative team, and there's so many different things to it that build to. I mean, it's one of the craziest jobs out there, right?
We'll get into that maybe in the third. We're going to take a break right here, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guest is Thomas McNaughton from Flour and Water and Central Kitchen. And what is this, how do you say?
So the Natimius Restaurant Group. Natimius Restaurant, the two partners. Flour and Water was the first restaurant to open. That's been about 5.5 years. Mm-hmm. Central Kitchen and Salumeria. Salumeria is our daytime larder, deli. You know, it's the cured meats that we make. It's jams, jellies, the olive oils that we're really proud of.
Okay, so South Jersey boy goes to San Francisco and now starts bouncing around Europe. Yeah. So what made you leave San Francisco for Europe?
So at the time I was working at Gary Danko's, and I just had a bug, you know? I wanted to go see things. I think that staging in Europe is equal parts culinary based. You're learning things, you're inside of a kitchen, but it's also personal experiences. It's like, you know, you're traveling around and figuring out the world around you. You know, culture is so intertwined with food. You know, you really can't have one on its own. And I really wanted to kind of immerse myself in different cultures and see things firsthand. You know, I think that a lot of young chefs, they think that has to be the milestone for them. They have to go to Europe. They have to stage in kitchens.
Do you find that today, too?
Oh, absolutely.
People are still going
to... So many of our sous chefs and, you know, they're biting at the, you know, they're chomping at the bit to go to Europe. And in reality, if you're just food-focused, you're going to get way more out of staging in America because you speak the same... There's not a language barrier, you know. It's like, you know, you really can... There's been so many frustrating times where I'm like, what is in that recipe? What did he add? You know, and there's just a complete communication breakdown. But it's part life experience, too. It's not just about the food, you know.
So where in Europe was your first Holy Grail?
I started in a Michelin star restaurant, Tantris, in Germany. And
is that in Munich?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I knew I wanted to just, like, you know, a lot of the young guys, I wanted to do Spain, France, and Italy. I staged for about 6 months, kind of hopping around different restaurants. Went to Paris, went to Northern Italy, Alto Adige, and it wasn't until my second trip that Holy Grail was in Bologna, in Italy.
You spent 6 months, mm-hmm, your first time,
right, yeah,
bouncing around. Mm-hmm. What was your greatest disappointment in Europe? Everybody goes there with great expectations.
Right. Sure.
What was your greatest disappointment?
I set up all these stages in restaurants, but they're very loose plans. I'm going to be there in the end of November, or, you know, you have to go see my friend in this town, and he's going to set you up for a stage. And because it wasn't concrete, the plan, I got stuck at some restaurants that weren't really that exceptional. But there's, I always think you can learn something. You know, there's nothing that you can't, you know, absorb. And the
what was your best experience?
In Bologna in the pasta laboratory.
Okay,
I mean,
that
it
was your
second trip. Right. And the first trip was, I mean, I staged at Michel Rostand in Paris, and it was just everything that you think of a fine dining restaurant in the middle of Paris. It was. I mean, it was this crazy kitchen and people screaming and yelling and throwing things and, you know, these amazing immaculate plates. And it was great. It was great to see that firsthand. You know?
What do you think that does for a young American chef? Is it really important? You know, you made your point that you'll learn a lot more maybe technically and product-wise in America. But what layer of nuance does going to Europe do for a chef?
I think that, like I said before, it's about immersing yourself in not just food but a culture and really seeing a culture firsthand. I mean, the dining habits of a different country are completely different, you know, and it's seeing like different layers to a culture and how that intertwines with food. That's probably the greatest thing that I took away.
So out of the trinity of France, Italy, and Spain, I guess I know this answer, but which cuisine inspired you the most?
On the first trip, it was France.
Really? Oh, I didn't expect that.
Yeah, no.
And why was
that?
It was just, had an amazing experience in it. And at that time, it was nothing but fine dining for me. And I really wanted to, I thought I was going to be the tortured soul chef of a 12-seat restaurant. You know, every single plate goes through my hands. You know, they're 18 hours, 7 days a week. And that was the goal at the time. And that's what I was seeing in Paris and in France. And and so, yeah, I just thought it was, you know.
Did you take some money and go eat in 2 and 3-star Michelins?
I was so broke. I remember, I was so broke. I would sleep on floors, you know. Honestly, for treats, it was like I would splurge and buy, you know, warm chestnuts, like roasted on the street, you know.
What do you think is the difference between an American and a French chef, let's say, you know, today working?
I mean, that's so difficult because, I mean, there's so many differences to each chef, you know.
Yeah,
I think that the dining scene, in France, certainly there's I think as the years pass, the dining culture in America is certainly becoming more and more casual. I think that has to do with a lot of things. I mean, you used to get dressed in a suit to get on an airplane, right? And now you have sweatpants on and a t-shirt. But I think that certainly what I saw in France is that the fine dining culture was so present, you know, and it was
elegant.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And that's why I was so engaged, because I really thought that was the path for me.
So for a troublemaker, you do look like an elegant guy. I have to say, what a good haircut! And but so what brought you back to California?
The first time I moved to California, it was reimagining food. It was tasting a turnip and being like, oh my God, that's what a turnip tastes like, or a piece of sage. And, you know, this simple basis of ingredients that were so amazing. And I love the farm connection. I mean, it sounds so cliche, and it's what so many people talk about, but that farm connection about, you know, going to feed the pig that we're going to, you know, have in the restaurant in the next month. And, yeah, it was that farm connection. And I was also, you know, I fell in love with San Francisco. San Francisco is a big town. It's not a city, you know.
But once you were in France,
right.
In Europe, so now you're coming back to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and working at...
Is it because you ran out of money and you were broke?
Absolutely. No, definitely. I mean, I went for as long as I could go,
okay.
You know.
Got it.
I had an open-ended ticket on the way back, and I went for as long as I could go, and always knew that I was going to come back to the Bay Area and San Francisco. And at that time, you know, when I first went to La Folie in 2002, that was the last time that I printed a resume. So much of it was, you know, immersing myself in the culinary scene there and building relationships, you know. And it really is this, I mean, with technology now, Twitter and Instagram and all of that, the industry is becoming, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. But it was certainly the case for me in San Francisco, where it was just such a small group of chefs that were doing amazing things. And so I already had relationships at that point. And
so you went back and worked where?
I went back and I went back to Gary Danko's just to kind of settle my feet and get back in the city, and ended up at Quint's restaurant. With Michael Tusk, yeah.
Oh.
I still have bruises to show. No.
So that was Italian.
All right, yeah.
So.
And that's where, I mean, whole animals, and certainly working directly with farms, and immersing yourselves in pasta production and butchery and salumi making, and which was an amazing small location. It was at the old location. So amazing small little restaurant. Yeah.
And so, and then how did you get to Bologna?
Why? So then I worked at Quint's for some time, and got the bug again, you know, and wanted to go out and to travel and see other things, and went back to France for a little while, but knew, and this is how it always works, it was like a friend of a friend of a friend that worked in Bologna, and it was at Bruno Franco Pasta Laboratorio, and
tell us about that. I mean, tell us the concept of Bruno Franco.
Right, so Bruno Franco is a salumeria, and salumerias in Bologna are always have a off-site pasta production. And they call it Pasta Laboratorios. It is not like a mad scientist lab. It's wooden tables with old Nonas rolling pasta out by hand. And
Nonas are grandmas.
Yeah. The pasta machines are all over Italy. They don't exist in Bologna. And it's a style of rolling out dough with a mozzarella, a very, very long rolling pin. Working in all these Michelin star restaurants, you know, I always say there's a common food language. I can go and work in Germany. I don't have to speak the language because there's a common food language. If you see somebody turning an artichoke, I know how to turn an artichoke. I can just belly up to them and help them out. You can see the looks on people's face that's behind getting set up for service, and you know, you see exactly like they do it.
This is running. Okay, let's continue. So, in this laboratory, how did you find it? And then
it was a friend of a friend that knew of it. I called him up. They at the time I spoke almost zero Italian and very little English, and it was hard to get it set up. But we finally worked it out. And you know,
were you in love with pasta at this time?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you were on the quest to find.
Without a doubt. And this was kind of like the holy grail because of the style in which they produce pastas. And not a lot of people even know about it in America. Going to these Michelin star restaurants, you know, you're always a little uneasy, but I was never really nervous. I mean, walking into this pasta laboratorio, I was nervous. It was like, it was
and
such
a... it really
a,
is grandmother's.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's not the screaming chef that's standing behind you, and I was so used to that. You know, it's somebody that's been doing a craft for 40, 50 years of their life, you know. They don't even think about what they're doing. They just go there to gossip every single day, you know. And
and how many people like Tommy were there?
Well, zero. So there was only one, only one ever stage. There was only one ever stage there ever,
and that
and
was
I was
you?
The second. No, I was the second
oh,
one.
Oh, you were the second one.
And coming back to America, just like I mean, just screaming how amazing it was and telling everybody. I don't even think they take stages anymore because they had such an influx. You know, doing interviews and talking
about it,
and certainly it's all throughout the book. I don't even think they allow that because it's just too crazy for them, you know.
So how long were you there?
Probably in total 3 to 4 months. Yeah.
And
so I rented an apartment.
How many different pastas did you learn?
Well, it's just really the amazing thing about Italy is how you can't talk about Italian food without talking about the regions, you know, and how incredibly regional the food actually is. And it was very specific pastas to not just Emilia-Romagna, the region, but Bologna, the city. And so tortellini and brodo. I mean, small tortellinis is the queen, you know, of pastas there. Tagliatelle, garganelli, you know, pasta bolognese is like, you know, obviously another classic from there. Lasagna, you know. But it was all about sheeting these doughs and how you produce those, and you know. But it was amazing. Yeah.
So we're going to take another break, and we're coming down to the home stretch. We got to start talking about not only your restaurants, but your beautiful, beautiful new book.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
So welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guest is Thomas McNaughton from Flour and Water in San Francisco. So, Flour and Water. Let's leave Bologna. Mm-hmm. Let's leave those pastas, and thank God you brought them to the United States.
Yeah.
So tell us about Flour and Water, and then tell us about, you know, the book, your really iconic brand. Right. And the most delicious, I have to say, one of the most delicious pastas I've ever had in America.
Yeah, I started Flour and Water with my two business partners, David White and David Steele, about 5.5 years ago. We formed Nate Timmy's Restaurant Group. And, I mean, it was the most chaotic restaurant opening that I've ever been a part of. You know, our budget was so low, and we bought a $500 used stove. We had a wood oven that we could barely afford. We were, you know, painting walls and putting together tables. And, you know, my previous chef, Michael Tusk, just bought, what was the new Quince where they moved. We bought all of his used equipment. We bought his used tables. And it was a shoestring budget. And we just started making pasta, you know. It was certainly the biggest learning experience of my career. Without a doubt.
Probably not from a culinary point of view.
From an every point of view. I mean, I never accepted a job or taken something on that I felt comfortable with. You know, it was always just trying to push myself a little bit more. And I mean, 5:30, the opening day, I wasn't in the kitchen. I was dry heaving in the bathroom. You know, just this huge, massive undertaking of a restaurant. There's a line that was already forming out the door, and we've never been open before. And we were supposed to do a soft opening, and that night we did 136 covers.
How many seats?
Yeah, there's 55 seats.
Ooh.
Yeah. And we've never dipped below that in 5.5 years. We've never done below. I mean, we're so fortunate to be that healthy of a restaurant, which is crazy. So,
as I said to you before, I'm so happy today because now I can almost get a reservation next time I'm out there. What did you want from Flour and Water Restaurant? You worked in the great American Italian restaurants, and you've been to Italy. What did you want from yours?
I wanted to know that I could do it. You know, I wanted to know if I could succeed. I mean, that's really it, right? And it just happened that Flour and Water, really the heart of the menu, evolved to be pasta. And we, you know, as we started to redevelop the restaurant, not redevelop, it's definitely the wrong term. I mean, just it evolved. And
was it first a pizza restaurant?
Well, that's what people thought, you know. Everyone thought that we were opening up a pizzeria. And I remember the first week, we probably sold double the amount of pizzas that we do now. Because everyone thought it was a pizza restaurant. And as we evolved the restaurant, we started to grow as a restaurant group. So we developed the dough room. The dough room was stylized. It's in the back of the restaurant. It's a separate building. And it's this beautiful, light-filled room where we produce all of our pastas. It was stylized after the lab in Bologna, and very similar setup. And that's where we make all of our bread and pasta and form all of our doughs. That's why we call it the dough room. Mm-hmm. And we just kept growing. We evolved from there. And when we developed the dough room, obviously our pastas continued to develop. And then we put on a test kitchen on top of the restaurant to develop the cookbook. And so we built a room, a test kitchen, essentially, to produce the cookbook, where we could work. You know, we weren't disturbing any of the restaurants, and you know, the photographer could work in there, the co-author could work, and we just, it feels like in the last 5.5 years we haven't stopped growing, you know.
So you have the cookbook, you finish that, you've got three restaurants and a deli. What's next?
We are about to open two new restaurants. So yeah, it's the same.
Glutton for a challenge,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. It's in the old Swedish American Hall. So amazing historical building. It's built in 1907. It has like two steel beams in it. That's it. The entire thing is has been continually operating. So on the underground is a bar called De Noord. De Noord has operated since 1907, even operated through Prohibition. And we're bringing Cafe De Noord back to kind of its 30s era. And so we rebuilt and we...
What kind of menu?
Americana bar. You know, there'll be a burger on. There'll be, you know, things from that era. There'll certainly be a raw seafood element to it. But things that were in that era kind of not redeveloped too much, but done our way. So we went Oyster Rockefeller. It's done our way, you know. So hopefully it's just fun, lively bar food, you know.
So a lot of chefs have this... You know, why open all these restaurants? Are you tired of just cooking in the kitchen?
I don't think I'll ever know the answer to that question. Glutton for punishment, like you say. It's amazing to see, and I think a lot of chefs respond this way, is that they have people that work underneath them and they want them to develop and to grow. All of our kitchens are 100% collaborative. You know, I write the menu with not just the sous chefs, but the cooks itself. And we sit in round tables and we talk about it and the things that we want to produce. And I think that's certainly an element to it. Maybe it's that ADD nature that's still there that wants to see different things come to fruition. It's like Café de Noord is underneath it on the ground floor. The chef de cuisine for the restaurant group, Ryan Powell now, we just made him a partner in the restaurant group, and we're helping him open a restaurant on the ground floor of that. It's going to be called Ache, and it's a Spanish restaurant. And it's that same idea of having somebody who's amazingly talented, and instead of him going off on his own and developing something, why can't we develop something with him, you know? And it's, you know, I think that we cook selfishly in the restaurant group, and Café de Noord is a place that I'd love to go have a Manhattan and a burger, and it's the burger that I'd want to eat, and, you know, and the place that I'd want to go, and, you know, I certainly know that Ryan feels that way with Ache, and, you know, Flour and Water is the pasta that I want to eat, you know.
So are you changing from being a cook / chef to more a entrepreneur / chef?
It's a hard development phase, right? I mean, my hands are the softest that they've ever been my entire life, you know? It's a hard development phase. I think that I'm an amazing ground floor manager in the trenches and seeing everything that's going wrong and directing people, mentoring, teaching, showing them how to do things. It's something that I'm really good at, and I've always enjoyed. And I think that's always why I've found success in kitchens, and to be able to push people and to have that drive. When you're doing that from a test kitchen or you're doing that from an office, it's a completely different ballgame, you know. So I'm even developing, just like developing your skills as a cook or, you know, developing yourself as a manager, it's a completely different management style. It's something that... I find difficult, you know, because for me, I have to be in it. I have to see it. I have to understand it. And, you know, I have to expedite the restaurants because I have to, I really want to see it. And I have to be in the thick of it to really help develop it, to help, you know, correct and problems. And I always say a restaurant's like a house of cards. It can crumble at any moment, you know. And so it's a different skill set. You know, I never envisioned myself to be a clipboard chef, nor would I be a clipboard chef. You know, I love the creative side. I love the, you know, the development side. But it's something that I've had to evolve as an entrepreneur, right? And that skill set of having a clipboard and you know, it's two different worlds, really.
Do you have any advice? We have a lot of chefs out there, cooks out there who are listening to this program. You know, I hear there's some kitchens. This airs at noon on Wednesdays, and they play it in the kitchen.
Okay.
So people can listen to these. So if somebody's a line cook right now,
right,
and wants to, you know, emulate what you've done, what do you tell them? What do they have to do?
I think that taking your time and really understanding, you know, what you're doing. We make vinegar. You know, we only use whole animals. Part of that is a little world, absolutely not. But if we make vinegar, we really understand the process. Then to season something with vinegar, we understand it a little bit more. We can cook a little bit more. We're more educated in how vinegar is produced than we're more educated in how we use it on a dish. And I think that's in line with taking your time, really understanding everything and not jumping ahead, you know. And certainly if you're a line cook, just like I said with evolving the restaurant group, when you're a line cook and you first start managing, management skill is something completely different than cooking. I know amazing, amazing cooks that are the worst managers in the world. And I know some best managers in the world that are the worst cooks in the world. You know, it's a different skill set. And I think that taking your time is really important to understand fundamentals. Like, to this world is so small, like we talked about with the internet. You can Google a souffle right now. You can Google that recipe, you're going to get it in 30 seconds, and you can produce it, and it's going to work. But you don't really understand souffles, you know. When you make 100 souffles, you really understand souffles at that point, you know, and what it takes, and just like the little tricks and nuances. And, you know, I think that with the industry today, you see people advance so quickly. And then they stumble a little bit because they've overlooked kind of the path that they were gonna take. I think that's difficult for me to say because I'm not the oldest guy in the world, you know.
We're gonna have to end soon. So I want you to tell me about this book.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different from anybody else's pasta book?
This book should come across in three ways. It's a it's a book that you can really crack the spine and cook out of. It has an artistic bent to it. It's really, you know, we shoved as many photographs as we possibly can into design. Yeah. Eric Wolfinger is an incredibly talented photographer. This book is about pasta. It's a single subject. The whole front of the book is just doughs. And then there's a large section of just how to utilize this book. You know, it's not just following a recipe, you know, because pasta, so there's so many different dimension that goes on there. And you know, it's a collection of recipes that we use at the restaurant. So what was so important to me is certainly with the photographs is all of these little pasta shapes. If you put it in written word, it's so complicated. I mean, I read pasta books where I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? I don't even know what you're talking about. So it was really important that we showed the step-by-step process. And we didn't want it to come across as an encyclopedia and have that artistic bend. So the design of the book and the design of those photos was really important to us. And so there's not a lot of books about pasta out there. And ones that aren't, you know, encyclopedias, which are, there's a lot of amazing books out there. And we wanted to really show how that's produced. We make spaghetti at the restaurant, and there's a recipe in here for spaghetti, and you can really understand how that spaghetti's produced. But you can go out and that spaghetti recipe is a great point, that you can go out there and you can buy spaghetti. We get in whole albacore tunas at the restaurant, and we tell you how we comfy them in olive oil to conserve them. But you can buy a great can of tuna and still create that dish. So there's different levels that you can hit on. It can be incredibly, incredibly in-depth on pasta, or it can be an overview, you know.
What's your favorite pasta recipe in this book?
Oh, man, that's putting me on the spot. I love to produce orchettis by hand. And it's something that is completely different than you can buy in the store. And I think it's really, really unique how it's shaped and formed. I started watching videos on YouTube. I mean, there's thousands of these amazing videos on YouTube of people hand-forming orchetti. So the orchetti with rabbit sausage is a great recipe to start from. And that's a great – you can buy orchetti. It doesn't have to be rabbit sausage. It could be pork. It could be chicken. You know, you'll still produce a great dish.
Yeah, you really want to put your hands in the flour immediately on looking at this book. Okay, one last question.
Sure.
If you could go to any restaurant in the world,
oh man,
where would it be? What would you eat?
Wow, any restaurant in the world.
Right now.
Is it an existing restaurant? It's
yeah.
Oh, really? Are you picking up the bill?
Yeah.
Okay.
The radio station, Heritage Radio. Hear that, Aaron?
Oh, man. Any restaurant in the world. I would go to Cellar de Can Roca in Spain, probably.
Oh.
Yeah. Rudy Roca was just here.
Oh, right?
Really
switching it up today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the Roca brothers are incredible. And
yeah.
They're inventive. Right?
Sure. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Inventive. They're amazingly talented. They're inventive, but I think at the end of the day, their food is familiar. You know, it's inventive, but it's familiar, and always kind of takes you back to a place. So.
Well, that was great. Well, this has been a wonderful interview. I really appreciate you coming, and I wish you a lot of good luck with your book. And for anyone out there who gets to San Francisco, I have to say, just keep trying to get a reservation. It really is an extra. And I'm glad you're opening more restaurants, so at least, you know, we're spreading your talent. We could all taste it. So thanks a lot for coming today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And we'll see you next time. Shout out to Robin Cohen and Jack Innes, our producers. And take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.